On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Mike Trout goes to Yankee Stadium and homers 5 times in 4 games. We spend the first part of this Friday episode marveling at the Millville Meteor and what he has done this season. It brings us so much joy. We also talk about ABS. The challenge system has given us 3 weeks of data. What is the most interesting parts of that that we can find? And of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, the ugly, and it is a doozy. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world old enough to remember when Mike Trout did this all the time. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. We got Joe Buck calling a game. We got Mike Trout dominating the fools. It's 2013 all over again.
Oh my goodness. This is going to be a treat of a podcast. Lot to get to, but let's not waste any time because I haven't been this excited to talk about Mike Trout. Just full, I am happy, I am enjoying it. There's nothing to be sad about. Mike Trout, let's do it. He's our opener.
There was a video during spring training that I've thought about a lot. It is one of those quintessential mic'd up behind the scenes looks at a player. And it is the Angels mic'ing up Mike Trout during spring training. It is like a minute and a half long. He does it in Mike Trout fashion, do all that much, but he is clearly having a lovely time. But there's one vignette in this video that is stuck in my head, and it is Mike Trout on the bench before the spring training game, sitting next to the son of his manager, Kurt Suzuki. And Kurt Suzuki's son, Kai, turns to Mike Trout and he says, "I saw a highlight of you like robbing a really big home run." And Trout laughs and he goes, "The one in Baltimore?" And the kid goes, "Yeah, the one in Baltimore." And that interaction is so instructive of what Mike Trout is for a certain segment of the baseball watching population. Mike Trout has not been truly dominant as a player since 2022, if you really want to squint, 2019, if we're being truthful. And that is now a long time ago. There are many people that watch our sport that do not remember that. Mike Trout made them remember this week. He made them learn their history with a dominant, exhilarating performance in the Bronx at Yankee Stadium. 5 home runs in 4 games as the Angels fumbled their way to a split of a 4-game set with some late inning catastrophes. But Trout going yard five times with Judge right there going yard 4 times was as memorable of a regular season series performance as I can remember.
Yeah, and I think, by the way, Aaron Judge, awesome. Nice to see him have a big week. We like
finally.
It's good because he was not the Ben Rice, clearly the best hitter, and Solvar statistically still the best hitter on the Yankees. But it's nice for Judge to kind of course correct and get his numbers back to awesome. So this is going to be a conversation about Mike Trout. We could do it in the relation to Aaron Judge and their relationship. And that made me kind of think about some of the same conversations we were having about Judge and Bryce Harper, how even though they're very similar ages, they've peaked at very different times. I think you could apply that at the very same way to Trout and what you could imagine that relationship is, even though to our knowledge, Judge and Trout don't have the same kind of close friendship that we've since learned that Judge and Harper do. So Aaron Judge, awesome. Yankees, you split with the Angels. You 2 walk-offs against Jordan Romano, who was a mess. Kind of a tough week all around in the Bronx. So let's focus on Mike Trout because, as you mentioned, it's been a while. It's been a little bit here since we had the whole baseball world focused on him. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But the most obvious reason beyond his own health is one that I want to make sure we're really not talking a whole lot about in these next 10 to 15 minutes, because it is the instinct to, whenever you start hyping up Mike Trout, to feel like, but the Angels, but if only we could see him. And it's not that those takes are wrong. I was having conversations with those people about very similar conversations just yesterday. I get it. But when you have a week like this and you have a series like this and you have this collection of five home runs, let's just bask in Mike Trout, the baseball player, who is now giving us these moments again, maybe a little bit after we thought he still could. And yet let's not be, I think it's ridiculous to be too naive here. We can talk about what he showed us last season and why we thought, okay, maybe we're never going to see something like this again. But I'm always reminded when I think about the best players of this generation, the best to ever do it, they usually always have another one or two or three more years where it's like, oh, wait a minute. Why do we think Justin Verlander was done? Wins the Cy Young at 39. Oh, Albert Pujols, sure. He's as cooked as it gets. Look what he did in his final season somehow, right? You think about Kershaw. You think about some of these other guys. When we are talking about first ballot Hall of Fame talents, if you just when you thought like, no, it's over, they're like, no, guys, I'm one of the best ever. Yeah. And it's when we're talking about truly one of the best ever in Mike Trout, we can't be that shocked.
Let's just quickly review the Trout timeline, right? So from 2012 to really 2019, he is as good of a baseball player as we have ever seen. That is not
at that hyperbole, age, especially.
That is a fact. From age 20 to age 27, okay, this is an 8-year run. He puts up 71.7 baseball reference war with an OPS over 1,000. This is an 8-year stretch with an OPS over 1,000, an OPS plus of 178. So 78% better than the average player, than the average hitter. It's preposterous. He wins MVPs in 2014, 2016, 2019. He should have won MVPs in 2013 and 2015. He should have five, whatever. And he looks like he's on the path to legitimately, statistically challenging guys like Bonds, challenging Ruth, Mays. We're talking about that kind of upper crust. Age rears its head. 2021 through 2024, let's say, he averages 66 games a season. 66 games a season from 21 to 24. For that time, 24 is a little different because he barely plays. But for that time, when he's on the field, he's like kind of still Mike Trout. In those little windows, he's producing not quite at the level that we had come to expect, but not far below it. And then we get 2025, which is just bizarre. He's on the field. He's healthy. He's DHing a ton. And in his age 33 season, he plays 130 games and is just pretty good. Not awful, not a bad player by any means, but not Mike Trout. He is not Mike Trout. 1.5 wins, 797 OPS, 123 OPS plus, 23% better than average. And it's like, okay, at least he's playing, at least he's happy, but we're seeing the decline, right? And what he has done so far in 2026, as he has moved back to center field full time, has been remarkable. So far this season, he is slashing .239, .393, .552. That is a .945 OPS, a 170 OPS plus. And if you go to the leaderboards for wins above replacement on Baseball Reference and you look at the position players, he is in fifth place in wins above replacement. He is 0.1 war, which is a rounding error, behind what he did last year already. Is this a renaissance? Will it sustain? I frankly, right now in this moment, don't care. I want it to, but let's just celebrate what this has been already and what we just saw at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, I want to make sure we're giving Trout his full credit, because I think your slash line is a day old. as I believe he's now up to 246, 416, 594.
Baseball Reference has yet to refresh this morning.
Or at least yours hasn't, because mine seems to be just fine. But yeah, and that's important because in this series finale yesterday, Mike Trout homered and walked three more times. So that's going to do a nice little number on your OPS, which soars over 1,000 again, which is nice to see. OPS plus of 188. And it's like, yeah, that's pretty much Mike Trout. I think that these five home runs that he hit, we should mention this home run streak is, I mean, once you get to four in a row, the circumstances of doing it in Yankee Stadium in a four-game series, that's also amazing. I think the great Sarah Langs had a note that the first player to do that in New York is since like the 1970-something. What these home runs looked like, when Trout is really cooking, I mean, he obviously hit them very far, but what we always understood Trout to be is this is the best low ball hitter that you'll really ever see. Like what the kind of impact that he can make with a pitch on the bottom part of the zone or even slightly below it is breathtaking. And he had a couple of these. I don't know if they didn't have the scouting report in New York, but the part of what has made Mike Trout more pitchable recent years is that you're just kind of blowing fastballs.
Everyone throws up.
We're just throwing up as much as possible.
Let's all throw up.
Now, I know, so I think I saw a stat the other day that he's generally just hitting all fastballs better this season. We could talk about maybe a slight mechanical adjustment that he's potentially made there. I know we're still working with small samples. But these homers, at least three of them, maybe four of them, being on low pitches, and it was like, yes, there it is. That is a pitch that if you are missing to Mike Trout, you are going to pay so obviously and so emphatically that makes me feel like, all right, well, if he's hitting these pitches consistently and he's not missing those, you would assume that the opponents are going to start pitching him slightly differently. But it was like, yep, there he is. That's the guy. That is the guy. And the one yesterday, wow. Oh, my goodness, did he hit that far.
The last thing like I want to talk about this series does involve Judge. Mm-hmm. With them in the first game of the set, each homering twice in a way that really did feel like punch, counter punch, punch, counter punch. Judge in the first, Trout ties in the sixth, Judge answers with a go-ahead in the bottom of the sixth, Trout has a go-ahead in the eighth. And every time they're homering, and they're looking at the other guy as they round the bases. And the camera captures whoever's in the field just smiling at the brilliance of the other. And that just felt so cool to watch that even Mike Trout is able to enjoy the brilliance of Aaron Judge in person and vice versa, right? Like, it's funny to them. It's special to them. And that came across in the moment. And that's relevant because, frankly, these are not the most charismatic, effervescent characters that we have had in our sport. But both of them have always looked like they're having a good time while they're playing baseball, which is not the case for everybody. And I think that energy that they exude is similar. And to see it together and interacting with one another on the field made this moment even more special, I think. So I highly recommend, there's a clip online that MLB posted, which is just all the Trout and Judge homers from the series with the shots of them giggling as the other one rounds the bases. And because Judge is in right field, the timing is perfect. Trout gets to first base. He turns towards the outfield. He looks at Judge. He smiles. And then he, you know, rounds the sacks. So that to me was very cool to see. I want to dig in a little bit now, Jordan, just like what is different so far about this version of Mike Trout? But physically, in terms of his swing, his athleticism, compared to 2025 when it looked like he was on the decline.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned him being back in center field this year from both an optics standpoint and from just a historical precedent standpoint. When you see the guy that's in center field move to right, but really move to DH, I think last year he plays 22 games in right field, which he was very open in saying, I did not enjoy that. And 106 games at DH, he barely DH'd. Even as he started getting injured over the last half decade, he was not DH'ing really ever. I think the most he DH'd in a season, in a single season, was 15 in 2018. But even in 2022, when he starts 117 games, he only DH'es 7 times, right? So that is a new role for him. And coming into the season, Trout was very open and saying, I did not like playing right field. I want to feel like Mike Trout again. I want to play in center. Now, because of all of his injuries, you can imagine that the average team will just be like, that's a bad idea. We don't want you going out there and playing as many games. Interestingly, what seems to be happening so far, and we're all going to cross our fingers and hope he can stay on the field, is kind of what's happened with Buxton, where Buxton, the Twins were doing the same thing. They're like, I don't know, man, you're hitting so well. We got to limit your time in center field. And he's like, guys, I'm a center fielder. Just let me go out there. If I get hurt, I get hurt. And now Byron Buxton has pretty much stayed healthy and stayed on the field. I don't know what's changed with him, but he said, I need to be comfortable.
Yeah.
Now, in his case, no one ever moved Byron Buxton to a corner. In Mike Trout's case, that felt like a sign for us where, okay, regardless of the, you know, war positional adjustment, how it's going to impact his total stats and career war totals, it just felt like, okay, well, we're trending towards something, and well, let's bring back in his offensive performance last year, which I know you want to talk about. This is a player that can still hit a lot of home runs, that is still going to draw a lot of walks as he still was last year. And you can look at some underlying metrics and be like, okay, this is still a scary power hitter.
Yeah.
But if he's DHing 75% of the time and playing right field, it's hard to say he's one of the best players in the game. You really can't make that argument. But now, as he seems to have made the adjustments to get back to being one of the best hitters in baseball and is back in center field, and now you can be like, well hold on. where should Mike Trout have been on the foolish 50 if we knew he was going to look like this?
Okay, so last year the biggest problem is he's whiffing and he's just striking out a ton. Okay.
Yeah.
Mike Trout last year. Well, yeah, when I say a ton, I'm not like, oh yeah, like he had some issues. If you sort by strikeouts, his raw strikeout totals, and this is with him only playing 130 games. He struck out 178 times. That was the 13th most in the sport. If you go by strikeout rate, he struck out at a 32% clip, which was the third highest number in the game on qualified hitters behind Ryan McMahon and James Wood. That is too many strikeouts to be an elite level player, which Ryan McMahon and James Wood were not last year. I know James Wood made the All-Star team, but yikes in the second half. So, okay, so what was the problem, right? What is, like, why is he whiffing so much? Well, I think when I go back and I watch some of the video, the bat just looked a little slow. Now, it was still faster than the average, but for Mike Trout, it was slower than what he has been in the past, than what he used to be. And I think that that is a relevant data point to look at why he's been so much better. He has had one of the largest bat speed jumps year over year, last year compared to this year. And that is a stat that actualizes pretty quickly, we've seen. And I think that that is related to him pulling the ball more. Makes sense, right? If you are swinging faster, you're going to make contact with the ball, usually, further out in front. If you make contact further out in front, it's probably going to go to the pull side. We know that there's usually more damage done to the pull side. And so I think Trout simply swinging harder is a part of this story. Now, why is Trout swinging harder? He seems to have implemented or re-implemented a very interesting mechanical change, which is that he is stepping backwards in space, so towards the catcher, with his back foot, that is his right foot, as he is swinging. Almost like if you ever were to do like a med ball workout throw in the gym where you're trying to throw it as hard as you can, you would like leap back and then push forward. This is something that not a lot of players do. Most famously, it is a thing that Nolan Arenado has done, and I believe still does, where you're almost like shuffling back to shuffle forward. It's very slight, but it is noticeable, and it is the type of thing that, even though it's not in his hands, it could certainly contribute to him having a little bit more bat speed. So that is my, you know, analysis as not a hitting coach or coordinator, as someone who just has the open side footage and the savant data. But that's kind of what I'm seeing when I watch the video.
Yeah, and it's hard not to think about just where he was physically last year. We see that he played all those games and think, oh, well, he must have been healthy. We should remember that he went for like the third time, and this is why right now we're just holding our breath here, for essentially the third time in 4 years, he went on the IL early in the season last year. He goes on the IL with like a left knee contusion, which that's the same knee that he had the meniscus tear and like what he's kind of been dealing with the last few years. He goes on the IL then, and because that had just happened, you know, in April is when he had the, at the end of April is when he had in 24, and he was off to a really compelling start at the beginning of 24 as well. And then he had it, you know, earlier in his career where when he started getting injured all the time, it's like, okay, he has this crazy hot start and then he's out. I believe that happened also in 2021. But then Mike Trout comes back. He comes back at the end of May and he basically plays the rest of the season. But you do have to wonder if he was just not at his best physically. And, you know, your lower half's going to be pretty important in kind of your explosion with your swing and maybe any mechanical things that you're trying to work on. He maybe wasn't able to implement those as effectively. The other thing I want to point out just about last year, you mentioned the strikeouts. That was a trend that was kind of creeping up even as he was still dominating. And that was really the first time we started, even when he was still slugging 550 or slugging 600, I should say, in 20 and 21 and 22, and he's still going to All-Star games and getting MVP votes. The strikeout rate goes up to 27, 26, 28%. When it is at its peak, it's, you know, 20, 21%, and it's with the walk rate, it's ridiculous. You can hold there at 27% and still be one of the best players in the league. 32, it becomes a little bit harder, and that's really what we saw last year. So far this season in a small sample, now we're back all the way down to, you know, 20% strikeout rate. So to me, I still think he's going to whiff a good amount, but if he can hold that in the more of the 25 to 28 range, yeah, there's no reason why he can't just hit 40, if he can stay on the field, that he can't just hit 40 home runs and walk more than almost anybody else in the league and maybe steal some bags. That's something I know a few years ago he really wanted to do, and maybe now that he's in center field, he's feeling more mobile. That's still something from like an injury risk standpoint you can imagine him maybe holding back on. But he's going to be on first base quite often if he keeps hitting like this. And I do wonder if he kind of pushes himself on the bases as well, which is certainly not something we've seen really since like 2017, 2018 is really when he completely stopped trying to steal bags. So that's kind of, I think you laid that out well. What's really working? You can kind of dig into the plate discipline numbers where he's certainly making way more contact in the zone this year, but we'll kind of see where that ends up. But from like a chase standpoint, a lot of these process things have never really changed. He's still going to draw his walks. He's not going to swing a pitches out of the zone. When he is making contact, he is generally making incredibly good contact. But now we're back. Last year, it was still good. It was still above average when he was making contact, and it was just too many strikeouts. But this year, just across the board, now that he's gotten a strikeout rate back to about league average and he's still walking a ton, this is what it looks like. This is like what one of the greats of all time looks like, which brings me back to what I was mentioning earlier when I interrupted myself, which is this home run streak, which now we can just get excited about. He's homered in four straight games. His career best is 7 in a row, which is one of the longest streaks of all time. That happened in 2022. So again, this is not in 2013 or 14 or 15. This is 2022. He's one of six players ever with a 7-game homer streak. The record, of course, is a tie between Ken Griffey Jr., Dale Long, and Don Mattingly with 8. Trout also had a 4-game in a row homer streak in 2019. And Mike Trout is about to play the Padres, who are red hot. They just swept the Mariners after mopping the Rockies. However, I'm looking at the pitching matchups, and I'm seeing some good opportunities for Mike Trout to continue to hit home runs, including knuckleballer Matt Waldron on Friday and Herman Marquez on Saturday. Michael King on Sunday, a little bit more tough. But let's see if he can keep this going, man. I'm enjoying this. Let's keep hitting home runs, Mike Trout.
I want Trout against Mason Miller is what I'd like. Oh
my God. I mean, well,
bottom of the ninth.
Decent chance we get that in some form. Yeah.
Trout, get your foot down now. Miller has been the best pitcher in the world. And let's see the best hitter in the world go up against him. Last thing I want to say before we take a break. I watched all of the Aaron Boone post-game press conferences from this series.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just wanted to see the way that he was talking about Mike Trout. And after the fourth game, a game the Yankees lost, a game I think in which Boone got ejected, he's asked about Mike Trout and like the sequencing and why was it difficult to keep him down and whatever. And he, at the end of, you know, his diatribe, he goes, he's one of the all-time greats. He's one of the greats. And it's that simple. It's that simple. Players like this are capable of things like this. And we just haven't seen it in forever. And so this entire stretch felt like a certain segment of baseball fan pulling aside the new segment of baseball fan, the people that have fallen in love with this sport over the last 5 years, which is a lot of people, and I'm sure some of them are listening to the show, and we welcome you with the most open of arms. And for those people, Mike Trout is a was, right? He is the past, but he is now very much the present. Something that my wife said to me over the offseason was, hey, whatever happened to Mike Trout? Which made me very sad. And last night, as we're sitting in the living room and I'm watching all the highlights from this week, I said, hey, babe, you know what? Remember Mike Trout? He's back. She was like, no way. I was like, yes. Yes, well.
And I'm sure there's another segment of our listeners that's like, yeah, duh. It's exactly. Mike Trout. Do we have to explain who Mike Trout is?
But we do.
And if you're listening,
but I think we do.
And you're and that like, person.
That's the thing,
I agree.
Dude.
I'm not pushing back.
We it's do just, have to explain.
That's what's so funny is those are two groups. And I'm sure there's other groups somewhere in the middle.
I mean, I know I started this talking about Kurt Suzuki's kid. But like, think about how many people have fallen in love with the sport of baseball in the time since Mike Trout was the best player in the world.
Absolutely.
Okay, that was Absolutely. 7 years ago. Like, and those people have not witnessed the magic. They have not touched God in the way that we have. They have not seen the Millville meteor streaking through the Anaheim sky. And so for them, they get to hopefully experience this wonder for the first time. You know, people always say, man, that movie was so good. I wish I could go back and watch it again for the first time. Wish I could go back and listen to that album for the first time. There are people, hopefully, that are going to witness Mike Trout this year being Mike Trout for the first time. And I am both jealous of those people and I am unbelievably excited for them.
I think I'll really feel it if he I'm putting a lot on him here.
If he
robs a homer. If he robs a homer.
Yeah.
I mean, like, come on. Like, I need the guy. If he's back in center field, I need him to go out. I don't care if he's like -7 OAA on the course of the season. I just need one play. I just need one play where he's, or even if he's just diving in the gap, that's where I'm going to be like, oh, we're there. It's happening. We're doing it again.
What I need.
That would be that. But
when do
but
they
for
play
now,
the A's? I need him to rob a Denzel Clark homer. Now, I know that would require Clark to drive the ball to the outfield, which he doesn't do often. Denzel Clark, who made himself into the home run robbery guy last year, I think that they play in mid-June. So, Mikey, that's your opportunity. Make it happen.
Well, let me also just say, we'll take a break. Too. I know I don't even know if we said his name when we talked about Joe Adell robbing three homers in right because Mike Trout's back in center.
Yeah.
Like there's something weird to that that was made me think like, oh yeah, Mike Trout's back in center. That's... Anyway. Okay. All right. I'm going to say enough Mike Trout, but I don't really mean that. But for the purposes of this podcast, enough Mike Trout. We're going to take a break. When we return, some ABS data that we're digging into 3 weeks down, and baseball is very different, and we're having a good time with it. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Everybody, get in a plank, do your crunches. It's time for an ABS workout.
Let us talk about the challenge system. We've, of course, already bantered plenty about it. However, with 3 weeks of baseball down, we now have numbers that are starting to tell us what this actually has done to our sport and how Major League Baseball is interacting with the ABS challenge system. This is a eternal rabbit hole. You could go forever sorting through splits on True Media and Savant and however you want to do it.
Yesterday.
Just, yeah, that's really all we were doing. And we decided to write about some of these takeaways, which you can read at Yahoo. And it's just so much fun because while to me on a base level, as we've said already so many times on the show, yes, in a very basic sense, it has removed a human element because we are now relying on a system to call very specific balls and strikes. That's true. However, it has also introduced so many things about this that are telling us more things about humans. And in a game yes. known for its eternal databases of numbers and statistics, now we have a whole new genre. So where would you like to begin, Jake, as we start to digest a daily increasing sample of data telling us how the system is functioning?
I want to begin with the characters that have opted out of this so far. Okay. And by opted out of this, I mean, who hasn't been challenging? This is a new tool. This is something that has revolutionized the sport. And whether it is because of a lack of opportunity or a lack of interest or a lack of comfort, there are certain characters that have not engaged with ABS. Jordan, I know in front of you, you have a list of the players with the most plate appearances that have yet to tap their heads. Run us through some of those names, please.
So this is a very specific list. This is not just plate appearances. This is who has seen the most called strikes, because that's really what we're talking about. That is your opportunity to challenge as a hitter, is when you take a pitch and the umpire says, strike. And you can, if your team has a challenge, you can say, not so fast. Not so fast, Mike Malinsky. Not so fast, Vic Carapaza, Laz Diaz. Tap, tap, tap. So who are the players that have watched called strikes for these diverse? And at no point did they think, I think that actually wasn't a strike. Or maybe they did, but held back for some reason. Here's your leaderboard. Number one, Chase Meidroth, my hero, one of my favorite players in baseball. 77 times he has watched a strike and it was not like, no, not my problem. He's like, I'm fine. I'm good with two strikes.
We're the White Sox. I'm chilling. We're not winning. We're the White
Sox. Number two, Bryce Terang. Another guy at the top of the order, very good player. Okay, Bryce Terang. He's not seen a reason to challenge. Number three, Jose Ramirez. This one is my favorite one on the list because Jose Ramirez is like, come on. I'm not going to challenge that. You. I'm Jose Ramirez. Mason Wynn.
And it's
Mike Yastrzemski. Well,
just quickly on Jose Ramirez. Quickly on Jose Ramirez. It is perfect. Because I did think heading into the season, we would get a player or players that didn't want to touch this at all. Because they just believed in their own process. In the same way, not the same way, but similar to when people asked Aaron Judge, are you going to do the torpedo bat? And Aaron Judge's response effectively was, I'm Aaron Judge. Why would I change anything I'm doing? I'm good. Like, I'm good at this. I'm good. Jose Ramirez is sort of doing that with challenges where he's like, oh, I'm going to get on. I'm going to hit it anyway. Like, well, I don't need this.
I'm too cool for this also. He's the person. He's like, no, I'm perfect. Way better than this. I don't need your stupid help. I don't need your robot help. Mason Wynn, Mike Yastrzemski, Matt McClain, TJ Friedl, Jung-Hoo Lee, Francisco Lindor, which we could speculate on here. And then two of my other favorites in the well, hold on. Before we do Lindor, two of my other favorites on here as hitters, again, most called strikes seen without challenging, Will Smith and Drake Baldwin. That makes all the sense of the world because they're like, I'll wait until I can just be behind the plate.
I'll do it later.
And we know that from a strategy standpoint, we can talk about how that has impacted certain teams. But I think catchers not challenging as hitters is also total. That I think we totally could have seen coming from a mile away. And seeing Smith and Baldwin on this leaderboard is very funny. Lindor is another one. I know he did finally get on the board with his first homer. We will talk more later about the Mets continuing to lose baseball games. But this, if we're just reading into 3 weeks of data and narratives that we want to build. We just did like with Jose Ramirez. With Lindor, it's just like he's just not seeing it. It's just like, I don't know, man. They're already making fun of me enough right now. I'm not about to go lose a challenge, lose one of our challenges. That would maybe be not ideal. But he also could be in the everything. Too cool for school bucket. He could be in the bucket of like, nah, I'm above this, even though obviously he does not have good numbers. But I don't know.
Now,
but
I think this is sort of
yes. Let's zoom farther out and do the team part about this.
So the one team that is sort of acting like Francisco Lindor is the Boston Red Sox. So the Boston Red Sox are so weird, dude. They're so weird. They're just not challenging on defense. In April, okay, this is in April, they have challenged behind the plate just 4 times. They challenged 5 times in March, like they were hot out of the gate, and they've challenged 4 times in April. To be clear, there was a game this week in which Austin Wells, the Yankee catcher, challenged 4 times in a game. The Red Sox as a team have challenged 4 times this month. This is not an accident. Maybe it's a strategy, but it's a weird one that I certainly don't understand.
They're not challenging on offense either. And I believe five of their 11 challenges at the plate also came before April. So in those first few games, they have challenged 20 times as a team in what, 19 games? In 18 games, they have 20 challenges. Now, you mentioned earlier, why wouldn't teams, okay, a lack of comfort, a lack of confidence, a lack of whatever. There's also a lack of success, potentially, because you don't have these infinitely. If you're getting them wrong all the time, then you're not going to have more of them to use. And so you can't rack up a total number. We'll flip this over and talk about the Twins here in a second. They are way ahead of everybody else in most challenges. But a lot of that is because they've been pretty good at it. And so they have been able to retain them and then use them later on. But so if you look at a team like the Nationals, who have been from a success rate by far the worst at 34% success rate total out of their 29 challenges, that is like, well, yeah, they're just losing them and then they just don't have them for later. Whereas other teams are able to rack up 4, 5, 6 challenges in a game. And so that's going to increase your total. But the Red Sox are somewhere in the middle. They have not been that successful, 45% success rate. I still don't. And maybe this is where the small sample comes in. I know that there are games, because they're out of hand in either direction, that maybe you're not as compelled to challenge. However, when you're this much of an outlier, I can't. It's very weird. And it is something that I am now so invested in tracking with the Red Sox on a daily basis, which is just like, what is taking so long? What are you waiting for? Why are Connor Wong and Carlos Narvaez just sitting back there not using these things? It is very strange. And I'm really curious to see. I'm surprised at how big of a split there is, I guess is the basic way to say it, even in this 3 week of data, between just how many sheer challenges there have been.
It's the meme of he froze. My guy hasn't challenged for 40 minutes.
Yeah. So not sure what they're waiting for there. But do you want to go back to the top end and talk about teams like the Twins? Talk about the individuals who have been tapping their head to the most frequently, both the hitters, which I think is most fun, but then also behind the plate.
I want to do the Dodgers first here, because the Red Sox are not challenging as hitters and as catchers. The Dodgers are not challenging just really on offense. So they have 9 offensive challenges as a team. That is the fewest in the sport. Everyone else is in double digits. So they have 9 as a team. But that doesn't mean that they're like afraid of doing it on the other side of the ball, because their catcher challenges are right in line with, you know, normal. They're even on the high end, actually. And Will Smith, who catches most of their games, has the 3rd most challenges in the sport for a catcher. So this, to me, is a clear strategy. The Dodgers are saving their challenges for defense. More specifically, they're saving them for Will Smith to use. So they're telling their hitters, hey, unless it's obvious, do not touch your hat. Do not touch your helmet. And when I went in, I looked at the Dodger challenges and broke them down, the 9 offensive challenges. 7 of those 9 have come 7th inning or later. They've come late in games. Now, this is especially relevant because that is actually, surprisingly, like, not the trend that we have seen, like, around the league. 39% of challenges, like, league-wide, if you take the Dodgers out of it, come 7th, 8th, or 9th. The Dodgers are at a 77% clip with their late-game offensive challenges, right? So, to me, for a team like the Dodgers, where nothing is an accident, this is probably not an accident. And the 2 times that they have challenged early in games as hitters, one was just like one of the worst calls of the year on Alex Call, where he challenged in a game they were already up 5 and he won the challenge. It wasn't even close. The other was a challenge from HS Kim, who immediately upon challenging realized that he shouldn't have been doing it, looked at the dugout with a guilty look on his face, and then grimaced in frustration upon getting the result that he had failed to overturn the call. And like, it camera cuts to Dave Roberts, and Dave's like, dang it. So it's clear to me that the Dodgers are doing a specific strategy, and their strategy is easiest to determine from the outside in the data.
Yeah, and they're not the only team that seems to be saving their challenges for defense. The Marlins, White Sox, and Brewers, Diamondbacks also have pretty high percentage of their challenges used while they are pitching. On the other side, teams like the Yankees and the Tigers and the Orioles have mostly used their challenges on offense. And we're still – these are the trends that we're now going to be monitoring, because this is still small sample. How many of these teams have extremely specific directives, and how many of them are – or maybe how many of them do have that and the players are just not disciplined enough to follow them. That's reasonable. And I think that's something that I think about now when I watch baseball on a daily basis, is just like, how often are hitters just emotionally challenging? And that is clearly not what they're supposed to do. You just give the Kim example. It's not hard to find very many others where you're like, there's no way this is like the situation that the team wanted this hitter or any hitter to be challenging in. And sometimes these guys can't help it, which is objectively funny. Because we would assume that they would conform and be using this strategy perfectly. And maybe at some point this season, there will be teams that you can tell in the data are truly following their own rules. I just don't think we're there yet for most of these teams. And that by itself is very compelling. Let's talk about some of the other players who have been using the system a bunch, including one currently at the top of the leaderboard after, I think, a couple more challenges yesterday that is particularly funny.
Gary Sanchez at the top of a leaderboard once again.
This is, like, I'm not sure there are people who just heard you say that did not know that Gary Sanchez was playing regularly on a Major League Baseball team. And I would not blame you.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, this is not someone that was trending towards any amount of relevance over the last few seasons. And yet, though he has only played 12 games and he is hitting quite well, he has 5 home runs for the Milwaukee Brewers, matching his total for the Orioles last season. Of course, back in Milwaukee after spending 2024 with them. This dude has already challenged 9 times, which now I'm wondering, has Gary Sanchez, okay, he's also challenged 5 times catching. So nobody in Major League Baseball, or I guess that's not true because some of the catchers have more than that. But in terms of the diversity of challenges, Gary Sanchez is living it up.
Letting it eat.
He's like, oh, I've been waiting to do this for years. So what do you mean you guys are just trying to pretend like you're too cool? I'm going to challenge left and right. So is this probably a quirk in the data that he's been coming up in all these situations that I guess make sense to challenge? Probably. But man, this is so funny to see. And I guess I'm looking at them right now, and at the plate, half of second inning, fourth inning, sixth inning, 7, 8, 9. So it's not like they're all in the ninth inning with the bases loaded.
The Brewers strategy is just let Gary challenge. Everyone, ISO ball, let Gary cook. Come on, baby. Second most challenges in the sport, I believe, is a tie right now between Jose Caballero of the Yankees and Kevin McGonigal of the Tigers. McGonigal had a huge challenge in yesterday's comeback win over the Royals. The Royals are, oh, they're wearing it right now. I think it's super interesting that Kevin McGonigal as a rookie is challenging so often. Rookies are challenging at a slightly lower rate than non-rookies at the moment. And I think that that is a balance of rookies not having like the institutional juice within a team to use the challenges. But that's evening out with them being more familiar with the challenge system as a whole. And so I think the numbers are going to end up probably around the same spot in terms of rookie challenges. But McGonigal being this comfortable challenging, and he's been pretty good at it, just is another data point for how special Kevin McGonigal is. McGonigal got an extension from the Tigers this week. Part of the conversation about him as a prospect is, you know, was he just has a really great feel for the strike zone. And here we see him having a really great feel for the strike zone and having the confidence in himself to do that right out of the gate.
The other reason, though, I love that I'm remembering is that this isn't someone that played 80 games in AAA with the system last year. Never played in AAA. So this is the first time he's using it too. I guess he would have had it in the fall league when he was MVP in the fall league. So I don't know the data of maybe he was unbelievable at this in the fall league and that, you know, prepped him for this. But McGonigal is a good nugget there. And I will talk more about him later. I think the last one that I want to finish on is just the catching side of things. Because unsurprisingly, this is really where these are really the ones that we're going to be watching because they're going to rack up a larger sample of challenges than anybody else. And so it's just, you mentioned this even after like 1 week, but it's not gotten any better. Edgar Caro of the Chicago White Sox has challenged more than any other catcher, 25 challenges, 40% success rate. No other catcher in the top 12 is less than 50%. Most of them are over 60%. And so that's really bad. But, you know, William Contreras and Will Smith, those guys are over 60%. Ryan Jeffers with the Twins, who challenged more than anybody. Him and Caratini have both been fantastic at it. Salvador Perez has been outstanding. He's challenged 18 times, won 13 of them. There's the catching ones, because we're going to have a larger sample. I think those are the ones from a skill standpoint now is going to be really compelling to see once we have a full season of data.
Last thing I want to talk about is the walk rate. So this is just super nerdy and nitty gritty, but walk rate in the sport is up a ton, like a ton. Right now, the league-wide walk rate is 9.9%. Last year at the end of the season, it was at 8.4. We have not had a full season walk rate above 9 since 2000. All right. Now, walk rate is usually a little bit higher in April as pitchers get honed in and the weather plays a role. But even so, the walk rate is up. And this reflects what we have seen in the minor leagues with walk rate once ABS is implemented. And I fell down a hours-long rabbit hole. You measure a rabbit hole in distance or time? I think it's probably both. A mile-long, day-long rabbit hole yesterday of why walks are up. Like, where are these pitches coming? Because the in and the out of the strike zone is not any different than it once was, right? The up-down is what's changed. The strike zone is now generally shorter because everyone was lying about their height than it was in the past. The irony, of course, was that by lying about their height, not that it mattered, but hitters are benefiting from this because the top of the strike zone is shorter than it once was, now that we know exactly how tall these dudes are. Even though more balls are being challenged into strikes than strikes being challenged into balls, because the top of the strike zone has been moved down, we're seeing a lot of pitches on the top rail being called balls. And I think that umpires are maybe slightly overcorrecting to that top rail pitches at the letters and calling the balls, even maybe when they do clip the zone. But just because a pitch is called wrong doesn't mean it gets overturned. You actually have to challenge it, right? And so for that reason, I think that is why walk rate is up. Now, I think that pitchers will adjust to this and start being in zone more. The in-zone rate, just like pitches thrown in the strike zone, is up, I think, 3% right now. Over the year, I think that'll go down as pitchers adjust to the new normal. But right now, walk rate is up, and 1.5% is arguably maybe noticeable in games. Over the course of the season.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the last thing that I will definitely be tracking, you know, I enjoy to follow. But I think next week will probably be a good time for our first edition of Why Haven't You Homered Yet? So things yes. where it's like, who's gone the longest to start the season without blank? And the version of that that I'm very excited to see is who can stay undefeated with the ABS challenge system the longest and who can stay winless. I'm counting 7 players who are 0-3 so far challenging, but I'm also seeing 2 players who have yet to be wrong with 4 challenges, and that is Marcelo Zuna and Pete Alonso are both 4-4 so far. So how long can Pete stay undefeated? Kurtz, Teo have also gotten 3 without getting any wrong. What is the highest number we see for someone that goes flawless with their ABS challenges? And what does that number actually look like? Or the opposite, which is how many can someone get wrong before their team tells them, hey, you can't challenge anymore?
Mitch Garver is currently 4-0 behind the dish. So maybe he can keep
behind
that
the dish. Yeah. I mean, that would be really impressive. The catchers, I'm kind of moving aside just because we assume that number is going to jump up a lot faster. But we will see. We will keep something to watch when Mitch Garver is behind the plate for Seattle. All right, let's take a break. When we return, it's Friday. We got the good, the bad, the ugly. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is the best time of the week. The good, the bad, and the ugly. I'll start, and I will talk about Dalton rushing. Catcher, DH, podcast guest. Tennessean. What can't he do? Dalton rushing so far this season is in a very interesting spot. He is the backup catcher for Will Smith, one of the best catchers in our sport, someone who plays very regularly. As a result, Dalton has only caught 4 games behind the dish so far this year. I believe that is every Roky Sasaki start and then one other game. He got his first DH start of the year earlier this week when Shohei Ohtani, with whom I'm sure you're familiar, got the night off in the lineup as he was pitching on the mound. This was the first time since 2021 that Shohei the night pitcher off. did not hit. He got half of a night off. And so he was just a pitcher. Just a very, very good pitcher.
So boring.
What a boring schlub. And Dalton rushing was the one who was sent into the breach as the DH, and he delivered, clocking a literal grand slam against the Mets. Dalton rushing is now hitting 529, 556, 1353. That is an OPS of 1908. 4 homers in 18 plate appearances. Is this sustainable? No, it is not sustainable. I believe he is above like Aaron Judge and wins above replacement. If you go to the Dodgers on Baseball Reference and you look at, you know, by war, he's 5th in war on the Dodgers with 4 games played it's a good team, behind Páez, Ohtani, Yamamoto, and Freddie Freeman. So yeah, what a thing, Dalton rushing. Let him play more.
My favorite. I mean, and we'll see how they work him into the lineup, because I don't know how many more off days Joey's going to take, but
it's a historic level of no space. First base, Freddie Freeman, future Hall of Famer, DH, Shohei Ohtani, GOAT, behind the dish, Will Smith, generational player, borderline Hall of Famer one day maybe. And so it's like, I don't know, Dalton, like, we tried you on left, you were not good at that. Second base, maybe. 2 DHs, maybe the Dodgers get like a disposition from the dispensation, not disposition.
I don't know. I don't know what the move is here. I wouldn't be shocked if he starts playing some more left again. Just from a matchup standpoint, it's at least plausible. But, you know, they also only have two catchers on the roster. So I don't know how much you really want to mess with that. So it's a weird situation, but it's just cool to see him take advantage of it. The one other from this thing from this that I wanted to mention that it was almost my good on its own. Part of the reason why Ohtani did not start or did not hit is because he got hit by a pitch by David Peterson the night before, or two nights before, like in the back shoulder. And I guess there was enough pain or something that the Dodgers kind of wanted him to take it easy by only pitching on Wednesday and, you know, striking out and doing his thing. But this is rare, as you mentioned. And so there was this great moment in the press conference where Dave Roberts is asked, what was Shohei's reaction when you told him that he wasn't going to hit? And Dave Roberts gives this amazing impression of Ohtani where his eyes just like bulge out of his head as if he's like shocked that he's not going to be hitting. It's very funny and got a lot of laughs in the room. But it's also, we've talked about Ohtani's kind of face play where we talk about just, which is some of the best in the league. But I also think that this is illuminating because this is an example of the Dodgers telling Shohei how this is going to work. And for an entire history of Ohtani essentially getting to decide what he wants to do at all times, maybe this is an exaggeration and Ohtani was fully on board and he was like, yeah, I'm good. It's fine. I am genuinely reading this as Ohtani finding out that he wasn't hitting and being surprised and then going out and striking out 10 because that's what he does and he'll be fine and he'll be back in the lineup and he'll be great. But I think this is something. Maybe it's just because he got hurt, he got hit, and they're playing it cautious and he'll be right back there. I'm not saying he's done hitting or done pitching or whatever. I thought this was interesting and also very funny. So just something to see. Ohtani maybe reacting, being told like, hey, no, actually, we're going to tell you what you're going to do. And you're going to be okay with it. My good this week, we just had talked about him earlier. It's Kevin McGonigal, who signed an 8-year, $150 million extension just a few weeks after debuting. The extension now, because we've had so many of them, we're like, oh, yeah, of course they gave this guy $150 million, whatever. Like, it's like we're like not even fazed by it. But if his was the only one, we maybe would have led the show and been like, oh, my God, they just gave this 21-year-old $150 million. But as we've seen, the extensions are all the rage. But to me, in this case, I know we're just talking about 3 weeks. He looks like their best player. I don't really know what more I need to see. Part of that is also informed by my skepticism about a lot of the other position players on the Tigers, to be honest. But whatever, whoever he's being compared to, the fact that he already looks like their best player, and not just the counting stats, the underlying stuff, the fact that he's the guy doing all the challenges, the fact that he's now playing some shortstop because Parker Meadows got hurt, so now we got Javi Baez in center, so he's bouncing between short and third, which is incredibly valuable. And he's a game changer, and I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed with this guy, and you can understand why the Tigers wanted to just make this happen. So I'm really excited to go watch him in person, hopefully sometime here soon.
Remember what that scout said to me? I asked if he thought Kevin McGonigal could play shortstop. Kevin McGonigal can do whatever the hell he wants.
Yep. Amen, brother.
Which includes challenging.
Apparently. What's bad for you this week?
We had some discourse earlier in the week, maybe it was last week, about how many people should be at a baseball game for you. Sal Stewart playing in Miami had, I believe, like 120, 150 people in attendance when the Reds were down in South Florida last week. Noah Schultz said, that's pretty cool, Sal Stewart. How about 500 people? Noah Schultz made his MLB debut for the Chicago White Sox this week. Schultz is from the area. Chicagoland kid. All right. Schultz, one of the top pitching prospects in the sport. He is outrageously tall. It is a Randy Johnson starter kit, even more than Chris Sale, just because he's way taller. Schultz is exciting. He was not particularly great in his debut. He flashed the potential, a little rust, you know, clearly not totally comfortable quite yet, but he's very young and he will be very good. Now, because Noah Schultz is from the area, he had 500 people at this game, reportedly. And the reason I'm doing this is bad is that's too many people, Jordan. That is too many people. Noah Schultz does not know 500 people. There's no way. There's no way all 500 of these people have met Noah Schultz, let alone have his phone number. Now, I went back this morning because I'm a sicko and I'm good at my job, and I rewatched the entire White Sox broadcast of all of Noah Schultz's pitching innings from this game. And Brooke Fletcher, who does sideline for the White Sox, said that a portal online was set up specifically for the Schultz world for people to get tickets that way. All right. That tells me that that link made its way around to some people who maybe shouldn't have had that link, right?
Oh,
500
yeah.
is unbelievable. It is literally unbelievable. Now, one of the highlights of this is that the entire Oswego East high school baseball team where Noah Schultz played was at the game in full uniform, many of them in eye black
wow.
and hats. They came straight from a disappointing loss at West Joliet. I think they dropped a Tuesday afternoon game, 5-2, 5-3. I went and found the box score in Max Preps. But I love the idea that the team loses just like a high school baseball game and they just, in uniform, head to see Noah Schultz make his major league debut. But anyway, that part of it was good. The rest of it was bad. Like, I don't know, keep your circle close. Keep your circle tight. Like, keep that link to yourself. I will say, as part of this conversation, someone tweeted this at us. Apparently, there's a gentleman on the New York Islanders named Matthew Schaefer, who is from the Toronto area. And so when Matthew Schaefer went to play the Maple Leafs for the first time, he got up to 1,000 people that came to support him. At that point, I think that then just becomes the fans. Like, you're just, right. like, you're just the fan.
As you said, Noah Schultz, does Noah Schultz know 500 people? Probably not. Do 500 people know Noah Schultz? Hell yeah.
Yes.
Especially if you have this first round pick from Oswego East.
Oh my God.
I followed up with a friend of the show, Charlie Goldsmith, about Sal Stewart in Miami. And he clarified, like, yes, it was a lot of high school. Also said his girlfriend is a big family. So if we're adding in a whole other family, you know, now we might be
very familiar. From my
wedding. Again, right, maybe that gets us to 100, still 150. 500, I don't know how many cousins you have. It ain't 500.
People are bringing plus ones,
and as you
man.
Mentioned,
people are bringing plus ones.
If you're
ones.
Bringing, if the whole high school is coming, it's just like, it's just a slightly different category. So, also, by the way, not sustainable. Not, you can't do this for it. Noah Schultz is going to be on the White Sox, and he's front. They're going to do this every, going to open up this portal every time he starts at home? It's ridiculous. I also should just mention, I wish Noah Schultz the best, but if you're saying, I'm sorry, Gen Z Randy Johnson debuted and you didn't mention this until Friday, well, it's because he's, you know, he's got some other stuff to work out. It's not, it's like, you're like, oh, he's, you know, Randy Johnson. You're no, you're right. He's the 6'10"
lefty.
Well,
he looks like Randy Johnson. Physically.
Yeah,
it's, physically.
He does.
Physically, we have never had a pitcher that looks more like Randy Johnson than Noah Schultz. That is a fact.
That's fair. That's fair. He's lefty, throws 98. I get it. Just to make it, just clarifying for those who may be like, oh, that sounds important. Why didn't you say that earlier? All right.
Well,
my bad this week.
You know how bad Randy Johnson was at the beginning of his career?
That's true. Hopefully it doesn't take Noah Schultz that long to figure it out. But if he becomes Randy Johnson, that's totally fine. My bad this week. You're never going to believe this. It's the New York Mets who have lost 8 in a row. And it's really like we talked about Steve Cohen's tweets and green shoots and all that stuff. I don't need to spend that much time on this. But if we're cherry picking like how bad the Mets have been during this 8-game losing streak, I think this is the stat that's really, really, really hitting me here. Okay. So I just, you know, went on Fangraphs. One of their best tools is, you know, custom date range. Okay. How's this team done over this span of time? Jake, would you like to guess the Mets WRC plus during this 8-game losing streak? So this is
71.
MLB, all offenses sorted since April 8th. Okay. WRC 71. plus 100 is league average. And you, what was your guess? 73?
71.
71. Okay, so 71, if 71 was the correct answer, that would actually rank 27th on this list. Because
the Mets last?
The Milwaukee Brewers have a 70 WRC plus over the last week, which is like, that's not great.
51.
The Kansas City Royals have a 61 WRC plus. Oh my God. That is 61 that's WRC terrible. Plus. That's 29th. Jake, the Mets have a 35.
Wow. That's not easy to do.
They're hitting as a team 175, 213, 257. A 213 on base. That they are pitchers hitting for a week as a team. That is what has happened for the New York Mets during this 8-game losing streak. They are pitchers hitting. And they're not named Shohei Ohtani. So
Juan Soto leaves town, hits the IL for 5 minutes, and the whole operation falls apart.
I think that's literally when Juan Soto hit the IL, right? Let me see. When was the last day that Juan Soto was in the lineup? A little bit long. Soto's last game was April 3rd. So, but yeah, pretty much that's what it is. So, really bad, folks. Wow. Really bad. Okay, let's go to Ugla.
Mark Vientos is on an 0 for 20 skid right now. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, it's been pretty awful.
All right, Ugla.
All right, what's your Ugla?
Jordan.
You go.
Let's talk archaeology.
This is so Ugla. So good. So good.
This is as good as it, this mean, is so as ugly as it gets. This is an article from the Penn Museum, a museum in Philadelphia. The headline of this article is Major League Archaeology. The Penn Museum welcomes Philadelphia Phillies legend Brad Lidge to our board of advisors. He calls it a quote full circle moment. This is by Quinn Russell Brown. This came out on March 31st. Brad Lidge, who both allowed one of the most memorable home runs like of the 21st century, the Albert Pujols homer in the NLCS, and then battled back from that to record the final out of a World Series in 2008 with the Phillies. He finished fourth in Cy Young that year, by the way, which is bananas. Two-time All-Star. Great player, great career. Brad Lidge's post-career pivot is a little different than most people, as Brad Lidge is now just an archaeologist researching the Etruscan civilization ancient civilization in Italy. And that's just what he does. He's just like a legit archaeologist. And I'm just going to read a couple great quotes from this. Quote, when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do after baseball, I had a strong inclination towards religious archaeology. That's most players, right?
Yeah. I mean, you always ask guys towards the end, like, hey, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do when you're
done? What's next?
Maybe real estate, open up a hitting facility, do archaeological digs in central Italy. The other great quote here is, I've put all the chips on the table to be an archaeologist. I didn't want to retire and just read about archaeology. I wanted to engage in it physically. Brad Lidge was not playing around. Brad Lidge is not doing this.
That is legit awesome.
Brad Lidge, that is the difference here, is that a lot of dudes, when they retire, like, oh, Randy Johnson is like taking photographs. It's like, okay. Like,
I mean, those guys are doing it too, but that is a more common hobby that you see taken up.
There is a photo in this article of Brad Lidge performing a drone survey. I'm going to read it. Brad Lidge performs a drone survey for photogrammetry of a medieval castle on Monte Vitozzo, central Italy. Like, he is in the freaking trenches, bro. He is looking at, you know, old murals. I'm sure there's a better word for this. The mural, like, he's not playing around. So, ugly as hell. Kudos to Brad Lidge on the pivot. Here you go. What's on the agenda for you in 2026 and beyond? If you ask most retired players that, oh, you know, I'll go watch my kid play Little League and I'll maybe go to spring training and I'll, you know, we got a vacation planned. He says, This spring, I'll be doing a ground-penetrating radar survey at our site. We're trying to understand a whole residential area that hasn't been excavated yet. I view myself as an archaeologist who is doing Etruscology right now, which is the study of the Etruscan civilization. More long-term, there are sites all across Europe and even back here in the Americas that I am interested in. Unbelievable. Great job, Radledge.
Dig it up. Good job, Radledge.
And I want to say quickly, all the people online that saw this tweet and said, he's out there looking for the baseball that Pujols hit. That is both funny and not nice. That is mean. Okay, Radledge is living a great life right now. Let him be.
And guess what? The reason why Radledge was in that situation is because he's one of the best relievers of his era. And he made $50 million playing Major League Baseball, which means now he gets to hang out and dig up archaeological sites.
It's great.
All right. My UGLA is San Diego Padres related, which, by the way, we have breaking news that we will finish the show with. But before we get to that, I'm going to do my UGLA. My UGLA is a tweet from Padres radio host Sammy Levitt. The Padres have used 17 different lineups in their 17 games this season. This genre of fun fact is something that used to grab my attention and me say, what? That's crazy. I can't believe what are the odds? And this is not to dunk on Sammy or anything. He's good at his job. I got no beef with Sammy. But like this tweet got like 1,000 likes. Everyone saw it's like, whoa, Craig Stammett, what's this crazy new manager doing? They got all these new lineups every day. We got some injuries. We're mixing. Tatis is playing second. He's doing. But friends, this is just baseball nowadays. Teams do new lineups almost every day. In fact, there are 5 other teams who have used a different lineup in every game this season. And I haven't seen any other tweets with 1,000 likes that mention it. That is the Astros, the White Sox, Rockies, Brewers, and Rays. And this is just kind of modern baseball. If you go back and look at last season, over half the league used at least 140 different lineups. Do you want to guess? I think you can guess. Do you want to guess the team with the fewest different lineups last season?
The Phillies.
They're like, bingo, spot on. They only used 92 different lineups, which, again, you know, some of them they used at most 10 times or 15 times. But Phillies, Mariners near the bottom, Cubs near the bottom, Padres also near the bottom. So maybe it's kind of unique, novel to them that they're refreshing it. And once again, this year, again, Mariners, Braves, Phillies are the teams that are not changing their lineup very often. The news is that the Padres have been sold.
Oh, we didn't get it?
We submitted a bid earlier this week, and it was a lot less than reportedly, according to Jared Diamond of the Wall Street Journal, $3.9 billion. Oh, my goodness. private equity billionaire Jose E. Feliciano and his wife, Kwanzaa Jones, at an MLB record valuation of $3.9 billion. Friends, we have already done a 80-minute podcast, 75-minute podcast, so I think we will wait for the details of this news and who Jose E. Feliciano is and the Seidlers and reflecting on this era of Padres baseball. We will do all that next week. But we wanted to include this because this is a huge deal for a lot of reasons. It's a huge deal for the Padres. It's a huge deal for Major League Baseball. It's certainly a huge deal for Jose E. Feliciano and the Seidler family. And perhaps if we're lucky, one day, a huge deal for Randy Vasquez. But we will cut off the speculation here, and we will wait for more reporting for that to come out over the weekend. The San Diego Padres, as we mentioned, will be tasked this weekend with stopping Mike Trout from hitting a home run. They're going to keep playing baseball this weekend. That would be great. Give him more money after this week. Padres trade for Mike Trout? That's okay. A lot of baseball this weekend, believe it or not. But the most important thing is that the Buffalo Sabres are playing a playoff game on Sunday. We will not be there, but we will be watching, and we cannot freaking wait to see our Burrs in Hocktober. The hockey postseason begins, and it's going to be great. So we'll see how much Sabres chat we get to do over the next few months, but I'm looking forward to it. Otherwise, Jake's got his Sabres flag up there. Otherwise, everybody, enjoy the weekend. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing, as always. Thank you to Mike Trout for, so good to have him back. And thank you to Tage Thompson, Rasmus Dahlin, Josh Doan, Peyton Krebs, UPL,
the whole crew,
Alex Lyon, the whole crew, and of course, Lindy.
Let's go.
Shout out Lindy.
Buffalo.
And Kevin Adams. Shouts out to him, too. And Yarmo. Thank you all for listening to Baseball Arborcast. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you soon.